Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13. I'm here with Michael Kester. And you feel that? There's some spook in here. Feels like some spook
bit,
in here.
A little chilly, a little ghostly chill.
Yeah, some ghost cold. I feel that. Yeah, I know what you're talking about there. We're doing a couple spooky fucking movies today. And, you know, sometimes we talk about some themes on the show. Sometimes before we record, I go, are there any specific points we'd like to make sure we hit? And then we just start doing the show before we record.
I know, that's the problem. And this banshee breeze in here just really like fired me up. We needed to talk about it. The spirit chill.
There's another one, isn't there? It's spirit something. There's a third one.
Spirit chill.
Ah, is it?
I think it banshee was.
Okay. So longtime listeners of Double Feature who've somehow found the show we used to do before Citizen Kane and the Godfather, which was also called Double Feature. It was called the same thing.
It had a lot of things in common with the show we're doing now.
The only thing that was different is it started, the numbering was system was different. We started with one instead of, you know, 390, whatever.
Yeah.
300, what?
400. You got to start with the 400 there.
I don't know. I don't know where we started this year. I fucked up that joke. But we... neither of us believe in spirit. Fuck, spirit chill? It couldn't have been spirit chill.
Fairly confident it was spirit chill.
Do we still have the producer's number here, or should send her a text? So we had a producer in the first couple of years. Maybe we still do. I don't know. I mean, she never really officially stopped, so I just haven't talked to her in a few years. And I don't know how this got started, but just every time we avoided supernatural movies for a while. And then once they would show up, we would all find the idea of ghosts to just be fucking hilariously absurd that anyone would believe in that. And so over the years, Banshee Breeze has come up quite a few times. And we used to use these terms to just kind of mock the sense. It was around the time that Ghost Hunters was really big and people were all going, oh, this is really celebrity ghost hunting. And they all believe. And it was, you know, all reality TV was infatuated with psychics and ghosts and all this crazy stuff. A simpler time when that's when reality TV was. Let's go back to that, actually. Let's go back. We're going to go back doing House and Burnt Offerings. As you mentioned, this is the 1986 House.
Right, right.
In today's Man vs. Lamp double feature, which is also... It is, right?
No, you're right, yeah.
I don't ever want to alienate anybody, and these things are so fucking funny to me. Can you give a quick... Previously on Man versus Lamp double feature. What is that?
Previously on Man versus Lamp double feature. Well, I mean, I think the king of Man versus Lamp was definitely Amityville Horror, I believe 7, which is called the Phantom Garage Sale or some such.
You just totally made that up. It's not 7. It's like 4, isn't it?
It could be 4. Yeah, you're right. I think they got there early.
I would look this up on the internet, but I know no one has ever talked about it.
So it's a haunted lamp that ends up being the cause of the ghosts throughout
you just
double
spoiled
feature,
my favorite part.
Man versus Lamp has been a very, it's a close to our heart, Man versus Lamp.
Yeah. I don't know if that's on the lexicon. Go on the website, doublefeature.fm. There's a lexicon of these ridiculous things that we have, as the Katamari wheel has spun on Double Feature, we have picked up such items. But I'm going to find out what fucking movie that was so people cannot watch it. This says The Amityville Horror, : The Evil Escapes.
That sounds about right, yeah.
: the punctuation, not like Evil Escapes from the : which is a totally different thing. I just looked up Amity Horror Lamp, so I don't know if that's real, but... Oh, this is here. This YouTube video says Amityville 4 lamp escapes scene. So that just sets up what's going on. Also, my other favorite Killapalooza meme, Garbage Day. I had about 10 opportunities to shout that out during these movies.
See, that the thing is, that I always
Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, that's must watch, must
I
watch.
I always feel like Garbage Day is, it's sad that Garbage Day ended up being the thing people took from that movie, because I feel like the other 89.5 minutes of the film are just as memeable.
They are.
I feel like the
You know there's a supercut, an eyebrow supercut somewhere.
I feel like if ever there were a cause for a 90-minute GIF image in the GIF keyboards, it would just be Silent Night, Deadly Night 2.
Yeah,
it's just
right.
in its entirety and then on repeat.
Yeah, well, this is, if you showed up thinking, oh, nice light show today, I'm not going to get anything out of this. Let me tell you, already, these things are magic. Go back and find them. Find the stupid lamp movie and watch it with Silent Night, Deadly Night 2. You cannot believe what you're about to see.
This is a good mindset to be in for today's show. If you haven't seen House, jump to the 24-minute mark. This is a really good mindset to be in with the show, because these are kind of our classic campy horror for horror's sake, in this case more than the next. Just these movies, they feel like your classic midnight movies that get aired at 11 p.m. on Saturday instead. Mm-hmm. They're these films that ultimately...
You mean 11 a.m.? A.m. or p.m. on that?
A.m. I'm sorry, I'm okay. In a.m.
I'm like, they get aired 1 hour prematurely, yeah, which is the signature
central time,
of the
Central Standard Time.
Yes, got it. What?
So I think the thing that I think is so interesting about House as a movie... The Fred Dekker movie House, aside from all the shit that actually happens in it, which is just great and fun from start to finish, I feel like House is one of these films, along with Night of the Creeps. Remember when we did Night of the Creeps?
Of course I do.
Or Fright Night from further back, or Monster Squad, or The Burbs. You know, these movies, these are the films that horror kind of built on top of to mock, but the mockery was laid on so quickly that I think that there's a whole vast generation of these horror fans that don't ever reach back to House and go, that's part of the cabin in the woods joke. You know, they don't see where horror, these are kind of the, I mean, I don't want to say they're the stepping, they're not the building blocks of horror, but mm-hmm. they're kind of the one-offs of horror that didn't get 19 sequels, although this did get one. It's called House 2, The Second Story.
I have worse news for you.
What's that?
Oh, you're not going to like this. You're not going to like this at all. I don't want to break your heart, but you brought it up. Oh, this kills me to do to you. It really does. There are four House movies.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't. I mean, it's like Prom Night. You say there's four Prom Night sequels and it doesn't matter.
Are you sure it doesn't matter? Because Puppet Master would disagree with you.
I disagree with Puppet Master. No, I just feel like these movies are not the films you think of as franchise films. I don't care how many sequels there actually are. You know, the fact that Return of the Living Dead 7 came out last year doesn't, I don't care about because there's one Return of the Living Dead movie. Mm. Same, like there's only one Matrix movie, and if they ever made sequels, I wouldn't see them.
Still on that, are you?
Never letting go, Jack. House is so much fun as a horror movie. It's not necessarily trying to use Babadook, It Follows style creepiness. It's not trying to get back to the roots of horror in any way. It is so concerned with being a contemporary horror film in 1986 that it's going heavy on the effects, heavy on the gross out, mm-hmm. and it's just supposed to be, I mean, obviously there's cats in the cupboard or whatever the fuck, but it's not trying to, I don't know how to say this in a way that doesn't seem super backhanded, but Todd didn't pick House, so I can say mean things about it. It doesn't care if it's good. It doesn't care if it's a great movie. House isn't coming out going, I'm going to be the best horror movie ever made.
Yeah, but I think it's not intentionally going, well, this probably won't be good, but we'll do it anyways, no, which is the other type of horror movie. Those are the only two types. No one's going, I have a masterpiece here. Horror at the time was basically, let's make this totally devoid of the fact that it's camp. Mm-hmm. And then the other side was the Friday the 13th style keep the lights on movies, where they would go, we need to make one of these quick, cheesy things because where the studio is going to close. We're out of money. We need another gig, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And both of these ended up playing a huge role. Although I think a film like House would kind of turn its nose up at Nightmare on Elm Street.
Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Some of the,
but not one.
Right. Yeah, good point. But all of Friday the 13th,
yes.
I think that would be.
Absolutely agreed.
And not absolutely the first agreed. Halloween.
No, right.
Definitely not the first.
Probably not the first two or three Halloweens.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Halloween, especially one, and I would say almost equally two.
And then you're to three, and three is a whole different thing, so you might as well include three.
Yeah. Sure, why not? Why not? three, they go, we need to keep this legitimate. Let's go ahead, and we can't make a third one of these Michael Myers films. That'd be ridiculous.
Right.
So even Halloween was in denial. But these movies, you know, Halloween 1 would probably hate being compared to Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. It would go, that's the poor man's Halloween.
Or Halloween 4.
This is 4. A series.
May also be.
Halloween 1 would hate being compared to its future Busta Rhymes movie.
Right. But oh, I think it would be lovingly attached to H2O, like we all are.
I keep a Busta Rhymes picture on my computer. I'd like to tell you about this now. This is don't do a spit take with that soda. I see you over there. So after 31, a lot of people started tweeting me. 31's the Rob Zombie film we covered a couple shows ago. People started tweeting me and going, hey, Rob Zombie ruined Halloween. And I would try to have constructive 140 character conversations with these people. But eventually it always just boiled down to, did you see the Busta Rhymes one? Because there was a Busta Rhymes one right before this. And so I just have a picture of Busta Rhymes that I just tweet back to people who say that.
It's not an image of Busta Rhymes karate kicking Michael Myers, though?
No, it's a pretty generic one. Oh, maybe okay. I should get some more. Follow us on Twitter and see how many Busta Rhymes images you can spot.
So at what point during your viewing, is this the first time you've seen House?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at what point during your viewing of the film did you realize that it was all a giant ploy by his ex-Vietnam comrade? At what point did you realize, I mean, how obvious were the clues up until the big reveal?
Because it's a giant metaphor and it all
right.
Like, leads at which to point a very did you, conclusive, obvious place. Right. Is that what you're saying?
At which point was this clearly a long-winded line, a long con by his dead platoon mate?
Well, listen, House is a film that drops a lot of very subtle breadcrumbs. And if you follow them, it leads you to a place that you could definitely anticipate, a vortex that you could... the missing sun and the blackness that you would... I don't know how the fuck the movie gets here.
it feels...
How, okay, can I tell you what please. I think happens in House? And
tell
you
me.
Just tell me if we even watched the same goddamn movie.
Yeah, okay.
So House... So there's a...
There's a house. All right, I'll start you off. There's a house and the guy from The Man from Earth moves into it. But before then.
No. The guy from... Fuck, what was that John Carpenter movie?
In the Mouth Henderson's? Of Madness. Oh, okay.
No, that's not a John Carpenter movie.
I mean, I get that confused with The Invisible Man.
It's true. It's true, maybe. Harry and the Hendersons, also one of these old haunted house properties. People didn't know that at the time, but if you've seen the unreleased conclusion, I think that I'm just going to let that simmer for a minute. People can imagine that and enjoy that. It's a free gift to them. So, moves in this house, which is maybe haunted because his aunt has maybe hanged herself, and the grocery boy, whatever that is, the guy from the Amazon grocery Peapod mm-hmm. service, right.
The kid who's been replaced by drones.
Yes. Yeah, right. And then no one would have found that woman. That's what would have happened. No one would have found her. Ironically, we use drones to kill people as well, so maybe it would have just been a shortcut. Depends what kind of drone is flying in. She. This is, makes more sense than house, this conversation. She dies, maybe because she's having a sad time, or maybe because the whole house is haunted. We don't know. This writer moves in there, in the Mouth of Madness guy, and he's going through, he wants to write a Vietnam book. This is the funniest fucking part to me. The movie goes, man, if a guy wanted to tell you a story about Vietnam, everyone would hate that, wouldn't they? They'd be so not interested, wouldn't they? Well, we got a movie kind of with a lot of Vietnam stuff
in it.
It's
funny because not only is it that, but it's double layered because they go, what if you came here expecting something horror related, but instead it was just a bait and switch about Vietnam?
Ah, the old Vietnam bait and switch. I believe we've actually fallen for that about 8 or 9 times this year.
Yeah, so the Vietnam War is this year's bunch of kids find a body. That's
I know. What the fuck? How does this keep... We're so prepared to talk about a subject I never thought I would be an expert in is Vietnam. But at this point, ask me anything. Just ask me anything. As long as it's about haunted houses and Vietnam, I'm there. I'm 100% there for you. So he sets up a bunch of cameras to capture ghosts because he thinks there's a banshee breeze in his house. Not his house, but his house, 1986. And he also starts reenacting Vietnam stuff, because why wouldn't you? And he's got a neighbor that just wants to eat pizza. That seems to be where the Americans drew their plot from, blatantly ripping off House 1986. It's only funny for the 5 people who've seen the Americans in the audience, not including you. So just take my word, they're dying right now. They think it's great. Or they don't get the joke, or no one has seen the Americans. All of the above. So at some point, so he moves out here. He's divorced or separated from his wife, and everyone already hates the Vietnam book that he has to just exercise from his body. He needs to get the Vietnam demon out, and does that through a bunch of flashbacks and so forth. But also his kid's missing. There's a kid, he's just not around. He like went missing or something. So that's a bad time, and he's upset because of that too. That's additional baggage. Now, at some point, a sort of vortex opens in this house, a sort of insidious-like, other dimensionally kind of, and he goes into it and manages to extract the kid. So I guess the kid got lost in the vortex of the haunted house, which I thought was just metaphorical. And also by accident, you know, the portal doesn't close quick enough and something else comes out, you know, that story. This Vietnam guy comes out. So I get the impression in this film that this is not an elaborate haunted house thing caused by Vietnam guy, but rather that there is a large shadowy haunted house thing happening, and it spits out a Vietnam guy. That's what I think is going on here. It spits out his kid and a Vietnam guy, and I'm going to do House a favor and say that's because his kid is actually dead, but he is able to go into the vortex and pull out dead things like his kid and like Vietnam guy.
Interesting. So
it all makes sense. The whole thing makes sense. Despite what anybody says, there's no plot holes in House, and even the people making House knew this. They knew exactly what they were doing the entire time this week on Double Feature.
Follow-up question, does it matter what happens in House?
There's a question in here that kills me. It's he asks his neighbor, do you believe in ghosts? And for the only time in the existence of humanity, the man responds to him by thinking to himself quizzically for a moment and going, well, what kind of ghosts? as if that's ever been the follow-up by anyone is, well, hold on, that depends. What kind of ghosts are we talking about here? I die. I don't know what... First of all, House doesn't know what kind of ghosts. That's why that is funny. But additionally, why would that make any difference at all? It's sort of like in my life I've met, I believe only one, but maybe more than one
ghost.
Atheist, afterlife, doesn't believe in the afterlife, doesn't believe you die and go anywhere, thinks you go into dirt, but also simultaneously believes that ghosts are real.
Huh.
And maybe that's the type of person that what kind of ghost is the question for. I'm not sure.
Right.
But the kind of ghosts end up being a lot of different ones. And I think as long as the movie, if the movie set out to go, man, House might actually be the opposite of Burnt Offerings in the sense that maybe it is a Friday the 13th, whereas Burnt Offerings is the...
See, I think that there's a 10-year discrepancy between the two that allows for there to be wiggle room. So this come, you know, House came out in 1986, which you or I know that the 80s are, for lack of better verbiage, when you wanted to make horror movies. Mm-hmm. That's when that was. It wasn't until the mid early 2000s that Adam Green and his ilk and his like came back and went, horror can be a genre. We can do horror and it can still be. Because keep in mind, in the 90s, that was that weird parallax sort of. Even John Carpenter was just going, what if Sam Neill was stretched out? What if that was how horror?
No one knew what was going on with
everybody
horror.
Everybody just went, can we just make Sam Neill a crazy man? That was horror in the 90s. Or they would take a seemingly unfrightening job and make it scary, like a dentist or a lawnmower man. Or an ice cream man or whatever you wanted to make a scary job out of, because the real danger is the working man. In 1986,
there's some psychobabble of a show in there somewhere. In
1986,
tell you.
I feel like House was setting out to be something that was enjoyable to watch for approximately 90 minutes. And I don't think that there is any point in this film where it fails at that.
No, definitely not. The thing that gets me stuck, and you're a New World guy, maybe this will lend some insight, I don't know, but New World movies are famously efficient budgetarily, let's say. How's that? Mm-hmm. Is that good? And this is one that feels like it has a little bit, I would say an unusual amount of character.
Yeah.
And extra stuff edge,
right?
Than an unusual amount of not boring you for any portion of the film.
Exactly. Yeah. Which see, you're the reason you're at a loss for words is because, and I'm just going to come out and say it, it's kind of not as exploitative as a lot of horror movies are.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you see a movie and it goes, this is a movie called House. It's a horror movie. There's creepy ghosts. And you go, okay, well, I'm sure I'll wait around. And then the last fucking second, the ghost will lunge at the camera and then you'll make four sequels. And I'll go, Paranormal Activity, you let me down. And then I'll watch the fifth sequel and still be disappointed.
I think this is more Roger Corman had an hour long meeting, but got stuck in traffic for 59 minutes of it and then burst in the door and went, it's about a house. It's spooky.
Sure.
And they went, okay, except fine,
keep
here's
in mind
money.
That Roger Corman would have definitely pulled the plug on half of the budget of this movie.
So maybe he didn't make it
to the meeting at all.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe he got stuck babysitting. No, I mean, that's the thing that happens in this movie.
I don't mean it's not an exploitation movie, capital exploitation movie, but lowercase exploitation movie is a movie where the poster goes, ooh, spooky, or ooh, women in cages. And then you go, you spend your sixpence and you walk into the Grindhouse Theater and the movie is 75 minutes of Sid Haig making rape jokes and 5 minutes of women in cages.
Right.
And I feel
like they did set the bar pretty low. All they have to do to not exploit is stay in the house.
Well,
they delivered. They did not trick me at all.
I mean, I think we're going to... Actually, that's a really good... So I feel like it delivers for 90 minutes. I feel like it is a 90-minute... I feel like there are 90 minutes of drones dropping what I asked for off at my house. Whereas here we go. In Burnt Offerings, it's nice. Kind well of done. This other sort of... thing. So this is 10 years before the heyday of horror, who fucking knows, right? But Sam Neill not involved in 1976. And this is still at a time in cinema where you need to make a substance prevalent in your film outside of, but it can just be scary and fun, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is a couple years before Friday the 13th, which keep in mind, still didn't realize it was being exploitative to the degree A couple years before Halloween. This is before Cronenberg. This is before any of these people that really made horror this gross, fun, effects-driven genre had footing in a way that they could influence the entire cinematic scene. So yeah. Instead, you have Burnt Offerings, which kind of exists in this vacuum left by Hammer horror. So you get, you know, you see Oliver Reed come back, who, again, to talk about Cronenberg, was, you know, to be seen in The Brood around the same time. And Karen Black, who always a fixture in horror. Rob Zombie knew this, which is why she's in House of a Thousand Corpses. But Karen Black was, you know, she came from that that Jack Nicholson camp when Jack Nicholson went legit after his Corman days and did Five Easy Pieces. That was where Karen Black came. You know, she's an easy rider, right? This is a film built from substance and a film built from legitimacy. And it kind of feels like the whole movie is going, please don't write us off as some schlocky, spooky movie. We're a legitimate film. Look at all these legitimate things we're tackling. We're tackling how hard it is to relocate. We're tackling family drama. We're tackling the idea of becoming overwhelmed by one's possessions and one's status and all of these. But in all honesty, compared to House, it feels like I showed up to watch a spooky movie and instead I'm watching Oliver Reed be read for an hour and then 30 minutes of actual 30 minutes of the quintessential spooky schlock. And not to say that it's a failure, because Burnt Offerings ends up actually succeeding in almost every single way it sets out to.
Yeah.
But it's just that the 10-year separation between these movies feels like a fucking eon.
Yeah. Right.
So, and I mean, I guess I didn't set out to do that when we put these two movies together, is kind of highlight how much horror evolved in 10 years. And Todd Cunningham had no idea that's what we were going to be talking about, because if we didn't know, Todd couldn't have known, but he did pick Burnt Offerings.
I think he did. I'm pretty sure he did. The last movie was produced by Sean Cunningham, which made me suspicious, but I think that might just be a coincidence. I'm almost positive it was Burnt Offerings. Whichever movie lent itself better to a conversation, assume that's the one Todd picked and he knows everything. And also is probably auctioning off a bunch of his haunted junk right now as we speak. So I don't know. Look for that. They get in this house. They have a lot of, you're right, a lot of these themes that I don't know if they are just kind of, I get the feeling they really did expand on this stuff. Whether or not they just went, I think they asked the unnecessary question of, so what do we do in this house for 90 minutes? What do we, what actually happens in here?
Right. And because they hadn't gotten to the point in time where Ty West went, I don't know, nothing, but it'll still scare the hell out of you.
Yeah. It's amazing how much House of the Devil there is in this, isn't it? I mean, this, when House of the Devil came out, I do not remember anybody citing this as influential, which is, I mean, everybody did a bad job on that reporting. They're citing stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which, you know, a home invasion film, that's fine. But I mean, down to the fucking Karen Black turtleneck. I just feel like, all right, so they come in, they get this insanely good deal on a new home. They're very happy. There's no catches. They actually get it. But last second, there is one thing. It's not really a catch. It's not a, you know, we have trouble getting someone in this house because there's also, it's not really, you know, we want you to take care of the house, but you're not just going to, you know, babysit it. We, mom's upstairs. And listen, she never comes out, but she's up there. I just want you to, you probably won't even see her. I just want you to know she's there, and just creep around her as much as you can and look ominously at her door handle, but just don't go in there or talk to her. You don't really need to do any of that. Anyways, we're going to go out, and you probably won't see us for the rest of the film. And we'll see you later.
Right. And you definitely won't see me until I start training a boxer that you may have heard about in Philadelphia.
That's just, I don't think anyone said that. Maybe they said that.
I said that.
the thing that marks the time for me for this has nothing to do with horror and everything to do with they don't know if $900 a month is a reasonable price for a giant fucking mansion.
Right? Yeah.
When go, today you can't even get a single apartment for $900 a month.
$900? I don't think we can swing that. No, it's for the whole summer.
Oh,
okay.
That's a good deal.
That might be something we can handle.
Today's remake of this would actually be $900. Oh, it's for a whole week. Oh, that is a good deal. That's a great deal. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
$900 the people who live in the middle. That's steep.
I know. Airbnb, right? Literally $900 a day. Fucking ridiculous. Where do people get all this money? I don't understand. It's like they have jobs or something. I don't know if other people do this. So the themes that it pulls in is a lot of the kind of stuff you would end up seeing in a movie like The Thing, or it's stuff that existed before and after Burnt Offerings, you know, The Thing being a remake. I think very much looks at infighting within a group, a little bit more suspicions, but you do start to get that in Burnt Offerings too. You get a family that's together in a house dealing with almost bad roommate type situations where they start to suspect each other of doing...
of eating their yeah, cottage cheese, though it clearly has Oliver Reed's initials on it.
Right. Totally. That's absolutely what it is. Somebody needs to be making that movie today. The movie where a bunch of teenagers live in a house and the house is actually eating their cottage cheese, but they suspect their other roommates. That's the modern remake of Burnt Offerings. Because of this, they start to kind of pick at each other a little bit. But there's also a side of remorse that I think is interesting to this movie, where each time one of these events come up, you know, the thing that happens in the pool in the beginning, Oliver Reed's character feels really bad about that. Even though he doesn't totally know why it happened, it just kind of was an accident. And then when people look at him, he gets not even defensive, but apologetic. I don't know what happened. It was an accident. Other people kind of reassure him. You know, his wife reassures him. You didn't mean it. It's not a big deal. It was an accident. Her mom, I think it's her mom, right? I don't know how the lineage works of the older woman they intentionally move in with, who seems like she would play bridge with the old woman who actually lives in the house. I don't know why that no one thought to do that. But she doesn't remember leaving a heater on with the window closed. And she, God, did she do that? I don't think she did that, but she feels bad. She feels bad if that happened. And so there is kind of an inner guilt to all these people that isn't necessarily the first thing you would get from a movie where a house is pulling a bunch of, you know, ghosts are running around pulling out the chair from people.
Right.
I think the natural thing that we see in movies anyways is people go, fuck you, I didn't do that. No, fuck you. No, you know what? This whole thing sucks. I'm out of here. I'm going to my room. And for people to kind of feel more sad and remorse is an interesting side of that that I don't think we get. Certainly not after Burnt Offerings and the more recent stuff. Maybe that was, I've never seen the original The Thing. Maybe everybody just sits around going, wow, am I The Thing? I feel really fucking bad about that. So the infighting ends in a place where Karen Black's character loves the house. And she's going to stay with the house.
It's inexpensive. How can you not like this house? It's inexpensive. It's got a built-in wave pool.
I know, but I don't know if they have that whole rent control thing yet. Sure, so the 900 might go up.
It could double and it's still a great house.
Rent control, actually, for people who find rent control apartments, those are the people who, I mean, the Burnt Offerings is just a documentary about those people.
Yeah.
They seem like they will fight to death for their apartment. No one can have it. And if you even challenge them on it, get the fuck out of here. I'm not moving. This is rent controlled. It's mine. Can you tell I'm upset about the housing situation? I don't know if you can upset. Can tell. So she wants to stay under all costs, and they get suspicious. They pull to leave, but it's absurd that they'd run away from a house that's eating them. And eventually, they kind of see, oh yeah, this house is getting healthier, and we are getting less healthy. Fuck this. Time to bail. So there's two points about this that are wonderful. And they are, to me, the character of burnt offerings that I think solidify its place in the other, you know, the circle of other movies that have been spooky and in a house. The first is that the house is actively, it's not as if its mission is just to kill the people off and it just stumbles at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always a weird suspension of disbelief thing there that the house just, it takes 90 whole minutes for the house to finally find the way to kill the people and doesn't just suffocate them in their sleep the first night.
Right. Or just collapse and then get, you know, like.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Just fall over. But this house is weak. It needs to be rejuvenated. And it does that by kind of beating the fuck out of these people. And so it slowly sucks their life force out, their ability to have their own cognition and be free operating individuals, to not just be in a catatonic state, and also physically their health. I mean, they all just seem to, you know, want a nap halfway through the film. Strangely, except for Karen Black, who's just great all the time. I don't know where to deal with. She feels great in this house. Wonderful house. And so as the house is getting healthier in a Hellraiser kind of style, it's slowly growing and putting itself back together until it is strong enough to crush the occupants and let the woman of the house take head. And so, one, that's a great reason to have the map of the film go out the way it does. But also really interesting, and this is probably doesn't come across as subtle as I think it does, but I like it anyways. Karen Black's, her character's transformation throughout this can be seen very distinctly by her wardrobe, which gets suspiciously more gothic, right, as the, you know, Victorian gothic as the film goes on. And it is fucking hilarious to me to see as time transpires over the summer, what should be beachwear ends up being closer and closer to, I mean, you know, we can't see an inch of a woman's skin, right? It becomes very old fashioned and very almost kind of medieval. Victorian, I guess, really is the right word.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that from, I mean, fashion people must go nuts for this. It does that from a contemporary style of, you know, the time of the movie, and then slowly starts adding these pieces of it until she's just, her hair and her entire sense of style is nothing. She doesn't even resemble the person that she was when she came in. And then you get to that final scene, and also she's aged and all of that as well. So that transformation is represented there. And then as you go back through the film, there are all these little moments that kind of push you more towards that. Even things like the swimming, right? She doesn't have her bathing suit. She's too busy with all her Victorian gowns. Who knows where those came from? And a point of interest for me in that is trying to figure out, all right, so if she ends up being the old woman upstairs,
which is horrifying, of the most frightening things.
It's great. It's great. It's really great. But does that mean that there, in fact, never was an old woman upstairs? Like, the whole time there was no woman in the house?
See, that can't be the case, right?
I don't know. Do they never see the woman? The whole time I'm going, you know, does she actually talk to? If there's no woman, then day one she goes up there.
But she's not supposed to go in there. Don't forget. She's just supposed to bring the food outside the room.
Yeah, okay. All right, so she just plants food outside the room and it gets. It's not that, you know, she makes the comment about you're not really eating a lot of it. Does that mean someone's eating some of it? Does that mean the house is nibbling on the food every night to make it look like someone's eating a little bit of food?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's thought about this, right? That's the answer. Doesn't care.
No. I don't. I definitely want to go on record and say that I had the same thought regarding Karen Black is now the old woman.
Yeah.
Because, and here's why. It's not implicit in when she becomes the old woman and Oliver Reed flies out the window and scares the shit out of his son by smashing his face through the windshield.
That's great. Yeah.
But it's implicit in the following scene, which they ripped off the double feature movie, where they pan through all of the times the house looked beautiful and then pan through all the families, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's why I recut that scene. That's exactly.
And that's the point where I go, wait a second. So if this is a regular occurrence, if this is, you know, an annual haunted lamp garage sale, does this mean that every, you know, year, 4 years, 8 years, four more years, whatever, that there's a new lady that takes root in the top floor?
What do you mean eight years? She's not elected into the house. It's over the summer.
Yeah, but it can't be annual. No way. The house does not get that dilapidated in 1 year.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, how long does it take the house to get that?
And is it maybe that the house in the dilapidation comes from the house absorbing the actual physicality of the woman upstairs? Is that a possibility? Can we say that's okay? Can we say the house eats Karen Black? Like Monster House style?
Well, yeah, because she would have to disappear then. Because it seems like she's in control and the house person in the end. But as the defender of the house, maybe it's more like a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing.
Sure.
Where her life force has been completely devoured, maybe faster than anybody else. And so the house has taken her over and uses it as its avatar. And
she's in a putrid stage.
Right. And so then, as being the only person left, the house lives off her for a little while. And okay, yeah. I think there's something in here. So what I'm actually trying to gauge in my head right now is
how drunk Oliver Reed was during the course of filming this movie.
Not cool. Don't make fun of Alcohol Reed. See, I did it. That's not what I meant to do at all. But now there's no going back. It's not like I could edit that out of the show. Oliver Reed's alcoholism is what I meant to say. Do you know anything about, this is a side tangent that everybody's going to be like, go back to talking about the movie. Was he up for Bond? Because I heard that he was going to be Bond before they went with Connery, and he like turned it down or something. Do you know anything about that?
Before Connery?
Yeah, they were like trying to figure out.
Interesting.
Yeah, he was like in the Maybe. Thing for no, the I know, role or the.
I know absolutely nothing about that.
Was eBaying his way into the. Okay, well, send us a tweet if you know anything about that.
What was the top secret super Ultra Saiyan information you knew about Karen Black?
Oh, well, so it's not Ultra Saiyan, but Ultra Insane, is that what you meant to say? It is Ultra Saiyan. It's Ultra Saiyan. No, well, Karen Black, you're right, she did die recently. And this is one of the first people, as we started working with Sheila Mia Safi. Mm-hmm. She's worked in the film industry a long time, so she fucking knows everybody. And this was my first starstruck moment by proxy with her, where she got, well, no. The first thing she told me is.
I thought you were going to say you popped your celeb cherry with Karen Black.
No, I'll just say it. The first thing she said is that William Forsythe was kind of a dick to her. That's the first thing I learned. So sorry to just throw everyone under the bus, but I don't think he listens to the show. Well,
my favorite part about this now is not that you said something about William Forsythe, but that in saying something negative about William Forsythe, in your mind, you've thrown the rest of the human race under the bus.
Right.
And William Forsythe is now watching everybody get run over by a bus. And going, was the light green? Was the light red? Does it matter?
Right. How much, additional content listeners. You have such great shows that you get. So that was the first thing. But the second thing she ever told me is before we went to any of the monster houses or met any of those people or any of that stuff, she told me that she was with Karen Black in some of her final days, which was extremely interesting to me. And then I asked the natural follow-up to that question.
Was she naked?
Hey, I want to know stuff about that. No. I think it's been enough years that I can say that, although I'm worried about throwing her corpse under the bus now as I've been put on the spot.
Just grab her corpse by the pussy, throw it under the bus.
Right, exactly. It's exactly what I was worried about. Can you throw the gorilla into this metaphor here? Can we just roll the Cincinnati Zoo gorilla somewhere into this? Enough people aren't upset and tweeting.
Listen, man, where does the 800-pound gorilla sit on the bus that runs over Karen Black's dead body?
Thank you. There we go. Thank you. Anyway, she knew Karen Black in her last days, and Karen Black was, and I didn't know this at the time, but I guess she was, I don't know if it was her whole life or just towards the end, but she was a very, just the LA busting some people outside, don't worry about that. She was a very spiritual, sort of mystical person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, sure.
And I guess that was a Scientology thing. And so as Sheila does makeup effects, so as she was working on, you know, prosthetics and makeup and all of that stuff, she spends a lot of time in an interesting moment with actors because their away time from everybody is in the makeup trailer. That's basically the break room where they get to, you know, talk a bunch of crap about all the people on the set and what's annoying them about the production. And it's where the drama goes down, is in the makeup trailer. And aside from that, they just spend a lot of time hanging out, touching faces. So as Karen Black was getting all her stuff done, they just spent, I mean, majority of the time of her final days with Sheila. And all Sheila learned was about her aura and crystals. And I don't know about anything about Karen Black. And that was the totally sane not thing that I learned.
That's awesome.
About Karen. It's, you know, you see these movies about spending your final days with somebody. Nothing was gained. Sheila probed not at all and just learned about her own aura. And that's why she's the greatest. I want to thank some other great people. That's David B. Anderson, Greg Winner, Aaron Shore, Kimberly Ants, Debbie Starin, Meta Somerville, David Koch, Lexi Love, and the guy who's probably not related to the producer of House 1986, Todd Cunningham. And fuck it, Sean Cunningham. I want to thank Sean Cunningham as well.
So one of those people you just mentioned really needs to cleanse their aura. I don't want to throw them under the bus.
I know which one it is. I know who needs aura cleansing. In this. No, I don't. I wonder if any of these people do aura cleansing. Are there any nonsense people in our executive producers list?
I don't think you get to that point and be a nonsense person. Not that kind of nonsense person.
Really?
Yeah.
There might be some Lexi Love nonsense. Okay. Tweet weird mystical things at Lexi Love and just see if she responds positively to any of them.
Sure.
Okay. So let's just set up a trap for her.
Just everybody tweet at Lexi Love, but simply tweet, this is it. This is what you're going to do. You tweet
a picture of Busta Rhymes.
Tweet the question, crystals?
Right.
The word crystals with a question mark at Lexi Love. That's what I want everybody to do. Just tweet crystals?
Right. Or tell her about her aura.
No.
She'll retweet
it. No.
Okay. This is a macaroni style. Just the word crystals with a question mark.
Just the word crystals.
What about if you speak Spanish and you do the upside down question mark first?
I mean, I'm not going to be the kind of person who says that if you don't speak English on Twitter that you can't play the game.
Okay, great. Now that we've gotten that important note out of the way, I'm at _ERICX13. You are at... Playing Michael in the way that you spell that.
That's
and
correct.
We have some movies coming up next time.
Holy shit, Eric. Next time we're gonna do a David Lynch thing because it's a round number. And it's so much David Lynch that it spills over into the second feature, but only a little bit because then it gets eclipsed by the Herzog. And I'll be honest, just to get you, let's see how excited I can make Eric. So we're doing Inland Empire. How excited are you? Where are you?
I'm very excited. I live near Inland Empire and I have not seen one of the last David Lynch films that I have not seen.
Then we're going Inland to pair Empire. That with the Werner Herzog film that David Lynch produced called My Son, What Have Ye Done? Mm-hmm. Which of course stars, you know, Michael Shannon and Brad Dourif in a dwarf.
Wow.
So
there's two David Lynch-y films and The Dwarf is not in the one that he directed.
I'm not going to say much more, but there is a samurai sword.
okay. Spot the samurai sword. That's
spot
what
the
we're
samurai
playing.
Sword. How excited are you now?
I'm no really time. Excited.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.